Welcome to the Teach and Retire Rich podcast, the podcast that covers retirement plan issues facing teachers, professors, nurses, school employees, and those who work in the nonprofit sector. Today's guest is a 52-year-old public school teacher in Georgia who, along with his school teacher wife, saved $104,000 in 2015. Let me repeat that. Two public school teachers saved more than $100,000 in 2015. Talk about teaching and potentially retiring rich. Not only are he and his wife hardcore savers, they are also willing to move school districts to gain access to better 403b investment choices or to trigger the separation from service provision that allows them to move their 403b assets to lower cost investments. 403b Wise readers may know our guest from a story he wrote for us called How I Escape My 403b by Quitting My Job. Without further ado, we welcome Ed Mills, a.k.a. The Millionaire Teacher. Ed, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on. I'm honored.
We're honored to have you. Scott, are you there?
I am here, Dan.
Scott, I don't know about you, but I cannot wait to hear this story.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this all week. I was very excited when you sent me the text saying we were doing this. So, Ed, welcome to the podcast. Excited to have you on. Should be fun.
Okay. And it is a Friday afternoon. Ed is home from school. And so we are going to each have a drink. Ed, what do you have there?
I am going to be a weenie. I'm having red wine today. I have a black box Cabernet Sauvignon.
Okay. The thrifty kind, right? The kind that comes in a box.
Well, I bought it at Sam's Club for about $15. Yeah, for two big bottles. You better believe it.
Another one of his wise moves. How about you, Scott?
I have today, I can't believe I haven't drank this on the show before, or maybe it's drank on the show. But I have, so I love white beers, so, and I also love IPAs. I've got this beer from the Deschutes Brewery in Bend, Oregon. One of my favorite places to be, where I plan on retiring. And it's a combination of the two. It's called the Chainbreaker. The Chainbreaker White IPA, and it's my favorite beer. So I'm excited to drink it.
Bend, Oregon's one of my favorite places. It's a mountain biking mecca, among many other attributes. So I have got what is the first time I'd seen this type of beer. It's by Santa Fe Brewing. It's called Adobe Igloo. And it is infused with something called cacao, which I had to look up, and this is the real word for chocolate. Yeah. And it also includes chili, and that's something New Mexico is famous for. And so apparently there's a bit of a spice to this beer. So I'm going to be having an Adobe Igloo, and it says, come on in, the beer's ready. So I think I should be opening this. Cheers, gentlemen.
Cheers.
Salute.
Hey, Dan, I don't know if you remember, but cacao was the safe word on the second
that
episode
exactly
of Portlandia.
That is exactly right. So one of the reasons I was late, Scott, to us doing a little prep before was I was Googling how to pronounce that word, and it's spelled C-A-C-A-O, and there's actually a TED Talk on it. And it's called Passion for Chocolate, in case you want to learn anything more about the cacao. And actually, it's a nut.
Huh.
Which I guess makes sense for cacao being a safe word on Portlandia.
It was a really weird episode. I don't really encourage people to use that as their intro to Portlandia.
Yeah, that's true. Oh my gosh. All Ed's fans are listening, you know, who might listen to this. That's their introduction to us. They're probably already going to turn off.
Didn't take long.
All right, Ed, I think you have a remarkable story. Why don't you just walk us through it? How did you get involved in teaching and saving such amazing amounts of money?
Well, I was late to teaching. I got in about 27, 28. Prior to being a teacher, I played basketball in Argentina and El Salvador. And then I traveled quite a bit, and I'd come back to the States and, you know, work here and there, substitute teaching or whatever. And, well, I realized I needed to do something. And during my travels and playing in Latin America, I learned to speak Spanish. And people found out in Georgia I could speak Spanish, so they wanted me to come teach Spanish at a rival high school in North Georgia from where I graduated. So, you know, I took a job there, and next thing you know, I'm a high school Spanish teacher, which is pretty ironic since I could barely pass Spanish in college as an undergrad. Yeah, you know, it's funny how life is, right? And I started in, I guess it was March of 1992. And after a few years of teaching, you know, back then teachers didn't make a lot of money. Not that we make tons now, but I think my first year on a provisional teaching certificate, I made $18,500. Yeah, so, I wasn't dying to stay in the teaching at those rates. You know, eventually I got my certificate and I was bumped up to 22. But I went off to grad school and I studied for an MBA and a master's degree for ESL and Spanish. I did 2 degrees, but from there I ended up in Saudi Arabia as an ESL teacher. And I came back after 9/11, and my wife and I at that point decided, well, since she had been teaching in Saudi Arabia at an international school, it would be better for us both to work as public school teachers so we could have time off together, summers free, and just, you know, live our life, start a family. And so in 2002, I found myself in LaGrange, Georgia, teaching. And I remember I came across your site, 403BWise, because I didn't know what a 403B was. So I started doing some research, and that led me down the 403B road.
Wow, so much there. Did you teach full-time before in the United States before going to Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, I taught about a year and, let's see, 2.5 years. I taught 1 year in Atlanta and a year and a half in North Georgia, small town, Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia.
And this was at the high school level teaching Spanish?
Correct. Which, you know, it was quite enjoyable, you know, teaching high school Spanish. It's just that the money wasn't so great. And, I was still relatively young and full of energy and had all these notions of maybe doing something in business. And then I kind of worked my way through my MBA and realized when I talk with people what they did, I probably didn't want to do that. So I didn't go use my business degree. I used it, obviously, as I combed through various prospectus for 403B products. So I know how to interpret that stuff.
Well, that's an important skill to have, and I think not enough teachers possess that. Ed, with your first couple jobs, were you even aware of the 403B? Did you understand that the pension? I'm assuming you had a defined benefit pension plan. How did you view the retirement plans available to you at that time?
I'll be honest. I never heard anything about a 403B. I knew of our Georgia teacher's pension. That was the only thing I was aware of. I do remember someone coming to the room one time asking me about, you know, secure your future or something. And, you know, when you have no money, that was the last thing I was thinking of. And at that point in my life, I didn't really know much about investing or retirement plans.
Well, your story is so similar to mine. I started teaching at 27. I knew nothing about the 403B until, you know, several years into my career. I had someone come into my classroom my first year teaching, and I had no idea what she was talking about. And I sort of had a vague notion of the pension plan, but I too knew nothing. Now, it's interesting. Your salary was only $18,000, and that's what you can contribute now this year, right? With a 403B, contribution is $18,000. That would have been your whole salary back then. So what led you to go teach in Saudi Arabia? How did you hear about that, and what was that process like?
Well, I knew if I went overseas, I knew I'd have the earned income, not the earned, the tax exempt status. So I'd be able to earn income without paying any tax. So, and I had a $20,000 student loan, and my fiance at the time, she also had one. So I figured I could go there, put my head down and take care of some debt. And I forget how I came across the job, but I just sent off a resume, and I had a message when I came back from vacation. And next thing you know, I'm flying off to Washington, D.C. to interview for this position. And I think about 10 days later, I was in Saudi Arabia. And it's one of those situations. Yeah, when they need you immediately. And so, you know, I spent five years there, and I was able to pay off all the debt and see a part of the world that, you know, quite frankly, is very difficult to get in there. And I took some awesome trips from there, you know, went to India from there, and through Europe. We passed through Europe every time. So it was a great learning experience. And I was able to, at the end of the day, we were able to save about $100,000 to $110,000 in those 5 years. So yeah, all in all, it really worked to our advantage to go there.
Well, a couple questions about teaching and living in Saudi Arabia. What kind of students did you work with, and what kind of school did you work at?
I worked at the Saudi Naval Academy. So I was dealing with first year, basically freshmen in college, with varying degrees of English competency. So you could have someone that knew almost nothing, and some people that were near native speakers of English. And their first year in school, they just tried to get them trained as well as they could in English, because their coursework and naval studies and things of that nature were in English. And did I answer both questions?
I asked the kind of students you worked with. I was wondering if they were Americans or Saudi nationals.
They were primarily Saudis, and there were a few other students from other countries in the Gulf region, like a few Emiratis, a few Kuwaitis, but almost all Saudis.
And what was it like living in such a restrictive country? And you said your wife joined you as well, right?
Yeah, about year two, I got her over there. Yeah, you really have an appreciation for what it is to be a Westerner when you go to somewhere like Saudi Arabia, because, you know, you play by their rules there. It's an Islamic country, and for example, when you go through the airport, they could go through your bags and looking for contrabands, which would be religious materials that aren't Islamic, wine, ham. So, I mean, you know, it's very restrictive. So you get a real appreciation for the freedoms that you have here in the West. As from my wife's perspective, obviously she couldn't, well, it's obvious to me, maybe not to the listeners. Women are not allowed to drive. It's just a whole different set of rules from here in the West. You can't wear women have to cover up for the most part. Now she wouldn't wear a burqa, you know, full burqa, but I would refer to it as something very similar to a choir robe when she's out, you know, just big and blousy, because women aren't supposed to be provocative, so to speak.
Yeah, my mother-in-law has worked for the State Department. She's retired now, but does contract work for them. And I believe the last time she was in Saudi Arabia, she was allowed to drive because she was declared an honorary man for a period of time. And I guess that's how they get away now.
Oh, wow. I'm not going to comment.
This is one of our great allies, right? And didn't they just do a beheading, which has sparked even more uproar? But anyway, that's not the topic. I didn't realize you were there 5 years. And I always think it's very interesting. In the back of my mind, I've thought about that, wanting to teach overseas. I've lived in England for 3 years as a kid, and it had an enormous impact on me. I think it does what you mentioned. It makes you appreciate your own country by traveling. It opens your eyes to so many other perspectives.
Very true. And you know, I've got my eyes some other regions in the world. You know, I want my son to learn Spanish and Portuguese, and I'd like to see more of Asia. So, and I have not spent, other than a 3-week trip to India, I've still got a lot of places in the world I'd like to check out and take my family with me.
We'll have to talk more about that, maybe even off air, because we have an 11-year-old son, and we have a 18-year-old daughter about to go off to college, and we've talked about trying to have these kind of experiences. So maybe you can give me some tips.
All right.
So you went to Saudi Arabia in debt, and then you came out, I'm guessing, in the black.
Yes, about $100,000 up. And while in Saudi Arabia, I had read some of John Bogle's books. And so I pretty much understood what I wanted to do as far as invest. I wanted to use low-cost index funds. And I believe I rolled my 401k from my employer to my Vanguard account. And like I said, I discovered your site and started snooping around at 403bs. And I instantly saw, you know, I called down the provider list, and I believe half the numbers were disconnected. I mean, you know, I've seen you guys cite the term Wild West, and I use it myself. It was just unbelievable. Like, no one knew what was going on. And I recognized a lot of the companies had, you know, the things that I hate, surrender fees, high expense ratios, and some of them had, you know, load fees. You know, pay money to invest. I'm sorry, that's a non-starter. But my first week at my job, I sent out a district-wide email advocating that we got TIAA-CREF added to the provider list. And the guy in human resources said, "Yeah, you said that if I got 25 signatures, he would add it." And within 2 weeks, we had it added. And so that was like my first experience of a little 403b reform. And I eventually got, I think a year later, got Vanguard 403B added. And so things were going pretty well. You know, at least I had a good 403B option in addition to my IRA that I was happy with. And so from, I don't know, 2002 to 2009, my 7 years there, let me look at my notes here. I saved about a little less than $350,000.
Oh my gosh.
My wife and I, and that would be in 403Bs, 457s, and IRAs.
Wow. So wow. You returned in about 2002. You come to the school district, which, you know, too many teachers have this experience. They see the list and there's poor choices. You were able to pretty quickly get two really quality vendors on. And were you I'm guessing you were maxing out right from the beginning?
Yeah. Yes. In 2003, I started, my wife and I did 30,000 to our 403B, and it was 12,000 a year at the time. And we did our IRA. So it was 30,000, and I'll just read it. Then it was 30, 32, 50, 55, 62, 56, and 64. That was all the way up to 2009. So we were just starting to plow some money in there. And every year, though, at that point, we did the 403B IRA. And sometimes if we could manage, we'd get money in the 457.
Wow. Now, what did you live on?
Oh, I'm trying to remember. Well, you know, when I came back, I had that $100,000. And we bought a house, and I think I put $42,000 down on it. And so we would live off. I mean, you know, we were making about $85,000 in 2003 between us. So, you know, one, like, obviously pay had come up since my previous time in Georgia. And so we were able to, you know, live decent lifestyle. We had a nice house, and, you know, cost of living in Georgia is not real expensive, especially as I travel and see other places in the country. I'm just trying to think anything else. And I guess I was pulling from that $100,000 in Saudi, because that was most of that money was, I would say, about half that money. $50,000 was in after tax. So I was able to pull that as I needed.
Scott, do you have any questions about that before we get into he ended up losing those options. I think that's the next thing we should talk about. You know, he worked hard to get Diakref and Vanguard, and then all of a sudden they disappeared. Any questions about, you know, up until that point?
No, it's actually very similar to my wife started teaching in 1997. And when, when we started to look at what their options were, they faxed me a one-page document, and it looked like a fax of a photocopy of a fax of a photocopy of a fax that had been, you know, stepped on and, you know, drink spilled on it. I mean, it just it looked like a historical document, actually. And when I got to it, I mean, there was stuff that was crossed out. There was like certain vendors would have like the phone number and it'd be crossed out. It'd be a new phone number. That'd be crossed out. There'd be a new phone number. It was I know exactly what you're talking about, Ed. I mean, I looked at this thing and I thought to myself, what is this? Like, I had always, and I hadn't, I was only 22 at the time, but I had already had two different 401ks, so I knew I just would, I'd just jump on, and I'd only have one vendor. This thing was just incredible to me. I couldn't believe what I was staring at. And there was no good options on it. There was no Vanguard, no TIA. I helped get those added. And I think, like what you're about to say, they eventually got kicked off as well. So it's interesting. That actually still happens today. I have people call me up and fax me or send me their approved provider list, and it looks the same. It just, it's insane.
I remember getting in touch with one guy on the list, and I told him, we're looking to max out our 403Bs this year. And it just reminds me of like the scene with the three little pigs and the wolf. He was salivating. He was like, he just couldn't wait to get his hands on the money. And I found out later, I'm really glad I didn't end up there. It would have been a nightmare.
Yeah, well, the other thing I noticed about the list immediately was that there was, you could not, and this is probably your experience, you could not buy a 403B unless it was through an advisor. Or, and I use that term very loosely, unless it was through a sales agent. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, sales agent. Yeah, an advisor with no fiduciary responsibility, huh?
Correct.
Yeah.
It's amazing how similar all these stories are.
Yeah, it's, how does something get so screwed up across every single school district across the nation? I mean, like, we talked to somebody in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. It's the same story as somebody in LaGrange. How do you say it?
LaGrange, correct.
LaGrange, Georgia, as it is in Southern California. I mean, it's hard to have such consistency, really. It's kind of impressive.
We're going to change it, though. In our lifetimes, we are going to change it. I am optimistic.
So am I.
Okay, you come back. You've got this really strong plan because of your advocacy. You're socking away a lot of money. And then I wish I had some music, like some dark, stormy music that I could play now. All of a sudden, it comes to an end. What happened, Ed, and what did you do in response?
Okay, this is where it gets good to me. About 2008, I guess that's the year we had the big IRS 403B reform where districts were supposed to be in charge of what they're offering. So at least my district was aware of this, and we formed a committee, and naturally they asked me to be on it. And that was my first experience working on a committee. And we went through it. We had a guy, a consultant, that walked us through it. And I realized that the district wanted one plan, okay? Well, that plan was not going to be Diakref or Vanguard because they had to have an advisor component for people that needed, for lack of a better term, handholding or professional help. And, okay, I understand that. But, you know, in the age of technology with computers, why can't there be some note that, okay, Ed Mills here, he doesn't want any help. He just wants access to rock bottom cost. It's funny. All these smart guys with MBAs, they can't come up with that. It's, to me, you know, it's one size fits all. And I believe we ended up just paying 20 basis points a year for the consulting fee. And, you know, I'm a frugal guy. You might call me a cheapskate, But when I know I can go to Vanguard and get total stock market index at Admiral Share for 5 basis points, and you want me to pay $20 for something I don't need, it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And that's when I had my my realization that, you know, I'm all for 403B reform, but I'll be honest, and please don't kill me, guys. I lose faith a lot of days, and I just said, that's when my aggressive basketball side kicked in. I said, well, to heck with this. I'm going to take my money and do what I need to do for me. And then I realized in my back of my reptilian mind that I have a 457 that I can use and load up. And I knew that that did not have the pre-59.5 penalty. So that as soon as I separated service, I could use all that money to live off of and cover expenses while going full-fledged 100% savings at my new job. And so in 2000, at the end of the 2008-2009 school year, my wife and I left our jobs in our home in LaGrange, Georgia, and we moved to beautiful rural Eccles County, Georgia, in South Georgia. Very, very rural place, and they had about 4,000 or 4,500 people in the whole county. And but, you know, it had nice people, a good school to teach at, and they had all the retirement accounts that we wanted. And from that year, 2009-2010, all the way for 3 years, we fully funded our 403B, our 457, our IRAs. And one of those years, we started our high deductible health plan and did our health savings account. So those 3 years, we saved $250,000.
Wow. I want to get into the HSA too, because that I think is just a sort of almost a hidden savings tool that may not be utilized enough. But I want to talk about the decision to go to this rural district. Was it primarily because of their 403B offerings, or was that also sort of, did you counterweight it with the quality of the type of job you were going to get?
Well, I have to admit, when I first called, I sent an email, then I had a message on my phone. I talked with the assistant principal that very evening, and we were talking. I was just kind of getting some basic information, and it sounded like a good job when I found out how small the district was. But, you know, in the back of my mind, that was a secondary factor. But it turned out there were 800 students, K through 12, in the whole district. So it was like working at a private school. Then, of course, at the end of the phone call, I summoned up the courage to ask about, let me ask you this. Do you have 403B and a 457? And he said, yes, we do. And, oh, man, I was thinking, yes, this sounds like ideal. And it got even better. It turned out there was no Social Security taken out in that district. And they actually had a supplemental plan that we were all vested in immediately that was 6% of our salary. So, I mean, it was a great financial opportunity and a great teaching opportunity.
Well, two things there. One, I've always believed that if we can get teachers asking that question, you know, what is your 403B like? What is your 457 like? That can have the effect of prodding school districts, I hope, and maybe I'm naive, to offer better choices. And then it sounds like your district is a lot like California. In California, you do not contribute to Social Security. Scott, any commentary on that?
Well, and there's several different states that have that, where you don't contribute to Social Security. But a lot of them, instead, you contribute to a pension plan. So did this school district not have a pension plan? Is that why they contributed to the Social Security alternative plan for you?
No, we have the Georgia TRS, which all school districts participate in, all public schools. This was just something around, I guess it was the mid-80s, early 80s, when I think districts who didn't participate in Social Security, I guess I shouldn't say districts, municipalities, they didn't opt in. They stayed out.
Yeah.
And there were some areas that did that. And so this little town I was in, they had no Social Security. And I was just, you know, and apparently there are a couple of districts here in South Georgia still like that.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. All of California, teachers don't contribute to Social Security, but they do contribute like 9% to their defined benefit plan with the California State Teachers Retirement System. So there's no sort of Social Security alternative in place, although there is for more not the non-certificated people.
Right. Well, here in Georgia, we do 6.25%, I believe, to our pension plan, and our district's kicking in about 11. Mm. And we also do Social Security at my current district.
Got it.
Yeah.
Hey, Ed, what did you do? I think I know what you did, but why don't you describe what you did with your 403B with your former employer? Because obviously by moving, you have separated from service, and that frees up that money. So what did you do with that 403B money? And I guess the 457 too.
Yeah. Okay. Before I left my job in LaGrange, my wife and I fully funded our 457 to get our balance up to about $90,000. And from there, once we separated service, we filled out the proper forms and had our 403B money sent to our to rollover IRAs at Vanguard. And that wasn't very hard to do. We did all that and it had it sent over. And at that point, I had a notion that I wanted to build my IRA up for something I was going to do in the future. And I'll go into that a little later. My 457 money, since I had separated service, I knew I could pull from that, but I think I waited to the next fiscal year. And then I started pulling about $30,000 a year out of that for living expenses. In retrospect, I was probably too aggressive on that. But at any rate, I wasn't really super frugal back then like I am now. But I was able to live very comfortably, rented a house in the country, and really enjoyed ourselves, and were saving tons of money. I went to my new employer, and I just would figure out how much I needed to put in my accounts to max them out for those years. And I did that for both of my accounts and both of my wife's accounts. And then I would take what any money remaining and send it to the IRA.
Wow. And did you, I thought I heard an interview with you and you described how you would front load these plans. So you would basically get no salary for several months.
Yeah. I'm a big proponent of front loading, like the mad scientist. Something I would do in LaGrange is we would say, okay, we got enough money. So January and February of every year, we would take no money. We would send all those checks into our 403B accounts. And then some years I would notice we would do it for March, sometimes all the way to April. And, when you really hammer those accounts, it leaves you the option later if you've got the financial wherewithal to load your 457. So by front loading, you kind of take care of business early and you're not trying to scramble at the end of the year to get money in. I'd rather kind of eat it and suffer a little bit at the beginning of the year and let it smooth out over 9 or 10 months. And that was just a very effective way for us to put big chunks of money in. And if you've poked around at my site or my little site on Facebook, I have some of my images in the background are like a check with a 2%, or excuse me, a 2 cent check. I used to love getting a two cent net salary for the month. That was awesome.
What was the reaction? I can picture, I'd love to see this scene where you go into the payroll office or benefits office and say, I want no money on this paycheck. I want to contribute as much as possible to my retirement plans. Was anybody else doing that? What was their reaction to this?
Well, yeah, there was somebody else doing it. It was my wife, but that was it. this is a good question because when you go into the payroll, they're in charge of your check and they're very hesitant to zero out a check. And I found out in LaGrange, for example, you couldn't zero out a check. So I could only get it down to the 2 cents. I had a little short-term gig in Columbus, Georgia, and they would let me zero out my checks. But I would say when you go to talk with those people, you might want to show up in person, because they're very nervous to do, let's say, a $4,000. They might think, oh, he meant 400. Go in there and explain to them what you're doing and be very nice, because they'll say, well, I don't know, I got to get that approved, or, you know, just tell them you know what you're doing. And, you know, I used to go see those ladies in the Grange all the time. I used to bring my son in there when he was 1 year old, and, you know, they understood what we were doing eventually. But you're gonna have to teach them about what you're doing.
Wow, that is so impressive. Another question, was it difficult to leave the other school district? Because I think there's a lot of people out there who want to make changes in their lives like this. And I think, I don't know if it's inertia or fear of the unknown. You are the rare bird, Ed. I don't think many people are doing what you're doing. I think a lot of people will put up with bad working environment, bad 403B plans, and stick it out. Any thoughts on that? Any suggestions for people maybe contemplating something like that?
Yeah, it is hard to leave. And my wife and I, you know, we were, you know, you get in a rut at any job, really. But we're about year 7. And I just remember saying, you know, the school year was starting to get hectic. And it was just pretty much time for a change of scenery. We would have both benefited from that. Well, and I asked her, when I said, are you happy here? And she said, well, no. Well, then I was, I used the phrase monkeying around, you know, with a spreadsheet. And I realized, wow, if we were able to tap into some of the money we have and fully hammer our retirement accounts, we would stand to increase our savings by $25,000-$30,000. And, you know, then that set off the mad scientist in me, and I did a spreadsheet. And I did like a little post that was just for my wife to explain to her what I want to do. And, you know, she's got an MBA. She's smart. And she saw that and she goes, let's do it. She said, yeah, we need to do that. And, you know, that's another thing here, that I have the perfect wife. She's perfect for me. I love her. She loves me. And she understands numbers. She's more frugal than me. And she can hammer a plan. So, you know, without her, I would probably just be some frustrated guy trying to earn 20% on his investments. Now, we're going for 100% savings rate, and we'll stick with 7%.
I think that is so important, being on the same page, so to speak, with your spouse. I think there's probably a lot of tension in marriages when that's not the case. So, Ed, to sum up, you lived on your 457. Because that plan allows you, once you separate service, allows you to take out money, and there's no penalty on it. So you lived on that and then basically tried to zero out your paychecks as much as possible.
Correct. That's what I did. And at the end of 2012, I was a head basketball coach, and I had an administrative duty. I was in charge of discipline. That was kind of one of the side benefits of taking a different job, is that, you know, depending on where you go, there's just different opportunities. In this small district, I got there and I had my specialist degree in administration, and they knew I played basketball, and they had an opening, and they asked if I would help them out and do it. And I had 2 really enjoyable years coaching. And, but, you know, truth be told, at the end of the 2012 school year, we were both just ready for a break. And that was the best job I've ever had. And, you know, everybody's like, why did you leave? Well, we just needed some time away from teaching, you know. And when you know you have a little bit of money and financial buffer to do that, it's kind of hard not to do it sometimes, you know. I wanted to say one other thing, though, about, you know, being assertive and making decisions that benefit you. You know, like most teachers, I do love the kids. And the older I get, that I like the kids more, as far as I have more of a nurturing side that I probably didn't have as a 27-year-old ex-jock. But at some point, if you don't like something, you have to make a decision and just do what's good for you. And I know it's not easy, and I know it's a little scary, but man, if you do it, the benefits are awesome. So I even sometimes when I'm going to leave a job and I really think, am I doing the right thing? I will pull the trigger, and I recommend it. You know, it's bought me a lot of freedom. It's helped me accelerate my savings rate, and just led me down some better alternatives.
I love hearing this kind of life story narrative, because I think we're just so programmed to live a certain way, and you're really, it's very counterintuitive, but I think the benefits are so obvious. Scott, do you have any clients like Mr. Ed Mills?
No, not exactly like Ed Mills, although obviously that's the goal, is to get everyone like Ed Mills.
wow, Ed, thank you.
Hey, if I could get everybody to max out their 403B and potentially 457 and Roth, I mean, they wouldn't really need me, right? yeah. It's great because, you know, if I do my job right, eventually my clients don't really need me. But one of the things I found interesting, and maybe you can speak to this, Ed, because I'm sure it wasn't a simple decision, but there's a lot of teachers who might want to make a change, but they're kind of in the system, so to speak. And it's those things that trap them that also benefit them. So the two things I'm referring to here are tenure and the column step salary schedule that most teachers, at least that I work with, are under. So, you know, if they move districts, they lose that tenure, and then they also lose that position on the salary schedule that they're on. If they've got, you know, a certain number of years, they might also lose some health care benefits. And so they're kind of trapped, so to speak, in the school district that they're at. What were some things that were these some of the things that you were looking at before you made the change, and did it affect you very much?
Well, I know in Georgia, after 3 years, you have tenure, and that transfers to the districts. There might be like a 1 year wait and see period at a new school, but I mean, not that I'm the greatest teacher every day, but I'm famous for I hate free days because that turns me into a babysitter. My kids are always going to do something. They're going to work. So I would just tell teachers, look, if you show up and you work and do what you're supposed to do, I don't know. Maybe there are districts out there where they're just dying to get rid of quality teachers. I haven't come across that yet. And I know in the state of Georgia, it was very easy to keep my job. You know, I would say as long as you're not showing up to school drunk and dating your students and you work, that's kind of been my world, my view on this. As far as benefits, I'm in Georgia TRS at every job I've been, so that I didn't stand to lose anything there. I know when I went to Eccles County, a smaller district, they did not have a local supplement. So I think that cost us about, I don't know, $4,000. And in my mind, I was expecting us to take a little bit of a pay cut going there. But at that time, I didn't understand the impact of no Social Security. You know, that was $300 a year or $300 a month not coming out of my check and my wife's. Plus, my district was putting that in another place for me. So, you know, sometimes you'll be surprised at how the numbers work out. There was really nothing to prevent me from leaving, because the truth be told, I will take a lateral job at a pay cut because I really make my headway through my savings rate, not by my income. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If all of a sudden in the state of Georgia they said, teachers, you know, 50,000 is the most you can make. So my wife and I would make 100, and I would still save 80, you know? So that's why I really like a high savings rate. Okay, your pay went down. Okay, I'm saving all my money anyway. I don't know. I might sound like a crazy man here.
Ed, have you been able to help any other teachers along the way? Have you described what you've done to them, and have they adopted some of your strategies?
Let me think. I get emails. People tell me they're reading my blog and they're doing that. Maybe Scott can identify with this, being that he works as an advisor. I can talk to people and explain things and they'll conceptualize, but getting them to follow through sometimes is difficult. Mm-hmm. And I find it to be very frustrating. I did all my CFP coursework at Florida State online, and I just don't think I have the temperament to do it. I talk and write with various friends of mine, and I think it's good if you get them to do 10 or 15% of their salary, you know? So, and that's one of the main reasons I just still continue blogging about it. And yeah, as you probably noticed, most of my blogs are spreadsheets, where I just show what I'm doing, because I think it is starting to sink in to some people that, you know, if you do save, that money goes to what I call your side of the ledger. It's your money. But if you do this kind of aggressive savings, you really see that mound of money almost mushroom as a function of your savings rate, not the investment return. So I can't say I've had tons and tons of success, though, in all honesty.
Ed, go ahead and say the name of your website, and we're going to say it at the end. We're going to put it in the show notes, but go ahead and why don't you give the URL?
Yeah, it's www.millionaireeducator.com.
Yeah, there's some great stuff there. I mean, I saw how you cut your cable bill. I know you went on a great vacation. That's where I saw your spreadsheet for how much money you saved. I mean, it's a very well done blog.
Thank you.
Very helpful. Yeah, good stuff. One thing before we go on to what you did after leaving this rural district. You talked about the exhaustion of teaching, and I'm not sure enough of us realize how physically tiring teaching is. You are on every day from about 7:30 to 8 till 3, and in your case, you're coaching, and that's high energy. And from what I've seen, we don't pay our high school coaches very much. Do you want to talk about the physical demands of the profession?
Oh, yeah. I'm still pretty good shape. I take care of myself. But I just noticed certain points of the year, you're wiped out. And I know anybody that works has a similar story. But I think one of the things about teaching is your mind is on. And if you have a rough semester, and in all honesty, my last semester is pretty tough. I would wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning thinking about scenarios, you know, dealing with individual students, and I couldn't go back to sleep. Or you wake up at 3 o'clock with a test question in your head. And so I wake up, I'm up at 3 many times doing stuff, and I'll come down and read or make a test or what have you. You throw some coaching in on that, and you know, you're in your 40s doing things like that. It's very taxing. I know teachers would like to complain. God knows we do that a lot. But it is a very tiring job, and I think anybody that's done it learns that pretty quickly. Anytime you have all those interactions with that many people a day, you're bound to have some things that go wrong and drive you crazy and just kind of stay with you all day. It's very hard at times to shut it off, so it's physically difficult and mentally at times also.
Yeah, I've been there with those 1 a.m. wake-ups, 2 a.m., 3 a.m.
Gosh.
I work with student teachers at the University of New Mexico, and I try to convey just how physically tiring this job is. And most of my students are in their early 20s. And the few that I have that are second career people, I think they get it quicker once they start student teaching.
Well, and I'm so glad I saved all my materials from 2002, because I know when I'm tired, my creativity level is rock bottom. So, you know, coming home and cranking out some awesome activity and exercise, that's just sometimes, frankly, doesn't happen. But I think knowing that going into the profession, I always tell any student teacher I'm working with that, hey, look, the first year here, you're going to want to quit 10 to 15 times on Friday. You're going to swear to yourself you're not coming back Monday. And you'll come back Monday, you know. But it's very natural to say, oh, to hell with this. I know I've said it many a time.
Yeah, I've been there. I mean, I did, I think it was 3 years, and then I took a leave of absence and moved to Washington, D.C., came back for 5 years, took about 3 years off, taught. Took a few more years off, got my doctorate, went back in the classroom. I like to joke that I've been trying to quit teaching since 1992, but there's just something magical, I think, about the classroom and working with students. I love it, but I find it very hard to do on a full-time basis. And I have great admiration for these teachers that have done it for 30 years without a break beyond, you know, everyone talks about the summer, but summers get eaten up by a lot of professional development.
Right, and grad school. And it takes about 3 weeks to just come off that nervous tension, you know?
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree.
What, you know, something you said about teaching, and that's something that I'm not a 30-year person, obviously, but it is a career that does allow for flexibility because every contract I've ever signed is for 1 year, well, 190-day teaching contract. And, you know, no one's ever told me, we expect you to be here 5 years. I naturally, administrators, they want continuity. But I've taken a job knowing that I'm going to leave after, say, 2 years, like this job I'm in now. In all honesty, my current principal, he said at the end of our interview, the interview went very well. He says, look, I got to ask you this because I got kind of a spotty resume. How long will you stay? How long do you think you'll stay? And I said, well, look, at this point in my life, I take it in 2 or 3 year chunks. And he just said, hey, I admire your honesty. You know, sometimes people are afraid that having that kind of shorter window is going to put people off. My philosophy is just be open about it. And if they, you know, a lot of times principals need people really quickly. And if you're going to fill the position for 2 years, well, it gives me 2 years to find somebody else. Another thing I was going to say is after we left our Eccles County, our rural district, we went back to our old town in LaGrange, and, well, people heard we were back. They offered us jobs. My wife took a job, and we hadn't taken any break because she was 1 month short of being vested in the pension due to maternity leave. But I, like an idiot, I jumped in and took a job, made a big mistake. Well, fortunately, they let me out of my contract. I was supposed to be teaching business ed, and I don't think that's the ideal job for me. So there I am, took the fall off, just kind of recharged and worked on some projects and jogged every day and did Pilates, things of that nature. About January, I was like, okay, I need to get some income for 2013. I picked up a 4.5 month job in Columbus, which is about 50 minutes from LaGrange. I helped that school finish out their school year with a Spanish position. You know, I just jumped in. I was very flexible, helped them out. They helped me out. And I saved, I think, $33,000 by teaching 4.5 months. And that's what, you know, you alluded to the flexibility. When you kind of take a flexible mentality and just say, I'm gonna take opportunities as they look good to me, you know, it's not hard to find out what the teacher pay is. You just pull it up, the pay scale, and then you go in there and talk to the human resources and just front load the accounts. And so I think from here on out, we're going to take that flexible approach.
Well, you're dealing from a position of strength because you have saved so much money. And I think that's a big takeaway. I hope that people grasp. When you have got that kind of nest egg, you can take these kind of risks and know that you're going to have a healthy retirement.
Yeah, my retirement is, you know, we're both vested in teacher retirement. And I think we're slated between us to get, I'm going to say 40 to 45 when it's all said and done. Well, the way we live, that's great. And we also have a nest egg that we can draw from. So, yeah, I mean, it's nice knowing you have that behind you. But the position of strength, my wife and I have these conversations all the time about, you know, a lot of teachers that they're maxed out as far as their paycheck's already been accounted for with whatever obligations they have, you know. And I understand when people get in bad circumstances, but in America, a lot of people, there's no frugal tendency. We just tend to spend everything we have. And I, the last couple of years, you know, after reading, I'm sure you guys know Mr. Money Mustache.
Yes.
I have really tapped into that message of frugality and have optimized my life to the point where I think we could live on $1,500 a month.
Wow.
Easy. And I'm counting rent in that.
Wow.
And do the things we do normally. And so, you know, when you can live on $18,000, $20,000, $24,000, whatever it's going to be, and you're saving 100% of your salary, that's very liberating. I feel like a free person, you know?
I'm a big fan of Mr. Money Mustache, and I forget exactly how I first learned about him, but through him, I came across The Mad Scientist and then a couple other podcasts I listened to. And so I've shared some Mr. Money Mustache interviews. There was a Washington Post one. There's a recent one on Vox, V-O-X.
Yeah, I saw that.
Isn't that just so well done? And it's very interesting. I don't know if you took the time at all to look at the letters back in the Washington Post story. And I lived in the Washington, D.C. area, and there's a lot I love about Washington, D.C. But I also know it's probably one of the most stressful places in the country. A lot of type A people making a lot of money. They have a very exaggerated self sense of self-importance. But there was almost anger in some of the letters to him. This is a scam. And I just had a laugh because I, from what I can tell, he's as authentic as they come, but he just is so counter to what we've come to expect in America, which is buy more, shop on Thursday of Thanksgiving, right? On Thanksgiving, go shopping. Geez. I mean, it's almost like a big Simpsons episode, the way this country behaves over the holidays.
Well, and I always tell people, you know, I'm a capitalist. I like the capitalist system. I like, you know, the quality of the standard of living it provides. But, you know, keep in mind that debt is marketed to you. And
yes,
when you get student loan debt, oh, my gosh, I'm talking to these young teachers. They've all got $40,000 or $50,000 coming from state school. You jump into a mortgage. You have a car payment. You get credit card debt. You know, sometimes I hesitate to use this term, but I'm sorry, debt slave. That's what a lot of people set themselves up for that. Maybe I should say debt zombie, but you get this sense of hopelessness because people go to work to service debt, not to build their nest egg, to buy their freedom. And, you know, I like shiny objects like everybody else, but I like my freedom 10 times more. So, you know, we, for example, we have two 12-year-old cars. Well, they're older than that, but we've had them for 12 years. I'm going to drive those things till they won't start. You know, it's not worth having a big house or a bigger house than you need is if you're going to work forever to pay for it. I don't know. It's a point of frustration for me. And, you know, the savings rate with the frugal living could buy people so much leeway if they would implement that strategy in combo.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. When I was living in Southern California, I lived in Orange County, and I was fortunate enough to have a job where I commuted east into Corona, California. So I went against the commuting pattern. The more affordable houses were in Corona and Riverside, and every single morning on the 91 freeway, starting about 6 a.m., it would be bumper to bumper for miles. And I was, again, fortunate enough to be able to have that counter commute. And I would think, why are people on this? Why are they stuck in the traffic? It's because they have mortgages to service and debt to service. No one would choose to live like that every single day. And then you have the exact same commute coming home. It's just horrible.
Well, it just goes to show you can condition people to almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure you guys have read things like James Altucher talking about why a home is not a good investment. First time I read that, I thought, and it just, I kept reading deeper in the article and I thought, God, I agree with this guy. And I'm not the only guy thinking like that anymore. You know, I'm 52. I rent a 2-bedroom, 1.5 bath apartment. And if you'd have told me at 52, I'd be happy living in this setup, I would have said, you're crazy. But I like paying you're going to love this. I pay $500 a month. My heating bill last month was $70. I have no yard work to do. I have a pool. I have a little patio on the back where I grill, and you know, it's and I can leave at the end of my 12-month lease and get my deposit back, and then I can go live somewhere else if I want to go to Florida, for example, or Texas, or anywhere. It's the world's my oyster in a sense.
Well, I have really tapped into this recently too, and I've had conversations with Scott about this, and I just pulled up an article that if anybody wants to continue reading about this, it's called "Why Your House is a Terrible Investment," and it's by I think it's James Collins, but he quotes James Altucher. He calls home ownership a part of the American religion. And I have to admit, when I first read this, I'm like, wait, no, that's not right. And then as you're reading it, and Scott and I want to do a podcast on home ownership. But I'm beginning to come around to that kind of thinking. Scott, do you want to jump in here? I've been kind of rambling. Any thoughts on this before we... I want to find out what Ed's doing now. And I also want to get Ed's sort of investing philosophy. I have a feeling I know what it is. And then maybe look at down the road for Ed. So, Scott, any thoughts about any questions, any things like that?
No, I mean, I'm kind of a fan of home ownership, but it's kind of a bigger topic than we have time for today. But I'm kind of interested in actually what the questions you have coming up, but also kind of interested in what you do when other teachers come and ask you for help. What do you tell them? What do you do? How do you help them? And do you also find that you kind of dominate some of your time? Do you get a lot of people coming up to you? And you know, how do you deal with that?
I wish that were a problem, but you know, this past year, it's been kind of weird since I do reveal my net worth on my site. And as you get to know people at your workplace, I just share with them my site. So they know my real, Ed Mills is my pseudonym, Millionaire Educator, but they read, and most of the teachers I come in contact with, they seem so swamped and behind the eight ball financially that no one really in the last year and a half has asked me much about what they should do, you know, or when they do, it's just, I know.
That's interesting, because what I find is usually like when one teacher kind of has it figured out, a lot of them want to like to kind of start piling on and asking, because for example, I was talking with a client today who had he's like the one guy that gets it at his school. And so like everybody comes in and he kind of finds it dominates his time, which is good because they're asking the right questions. They're asking the right questions, but you're kind of telling me that people aren't really asking you this stuff.
Well, and I think most people take the 30-year view. They are, I guess Tim Ferriss would call this the deferred lifestyle. They're going to work their 30 years and just put their head down, and that's their retirement. And then Social Security at 70, let's say. So they're not looking – see, I don't view this 403B and 457 that I have access to as a retirement account. I view it as a freedom account that I can use now. And – I guess that's what makes me different in a sense. But, you know, after our job in Eccles County, is it now a good time for me to explain what exactly I did to free up myself? I went right to, I took my Vanguard IRA and I did the 72T provision. So I got an income stream from it. So my line of thinking was I was going to use these retirement accounts to fund my, I don't want to call it early retirement because I do work here and there, but to start a stream of income to give me some sense of financial independence. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And actually, that's something we wanted to focus on. 72T is a section that most people aren't familiar with, probably won't need to be familiar with considering most won't retire until after 55. But why don't you kind of give us a quick overview on what Section 72T is and how you're using it exactly what it is.
First of all, a lot of people, when they'll write me emails and say, where can I get a 72T? It's not a product or thing you buy.
I want one of those too.
Yeah. It's part of the IRS tax code that allows you to access your retirement money before age 59 and a half. And the way it would work for most people, at least this is my understanding, this is the way I use it, is I use the substantially equal periodic payments, which means, you know, basically I'm turning my IRA annuity into a, or my IRA, I'm annuitizing it, and I'm pulling out a set amount at a set interest rate over my life expectancy. So as it works out for my wife and I, we're able to get about $10,000 from mine and about $8,000 from hers. So, I mean, that's not a ton of money, but it'll cover our living expenses or help a lot. And then, like I said before, with that money from the 72T distributions, I can also pull strategically from my 457 account once I separate service. Okay. The truth be told, knowing what I know now, I probably would have opted for a Roth IRA conversion ladder. And you can Google that. A lot of good articles about that out there. But this did help me set up some current income without penalty.
Ed, did you set this up by yourself? Did you work with a planner? How did you come across this?
Well, I did this myself. And I have to admit, I was nervous about the calculation because it does have penalties that are retroactive if you screw it up. But I just went to the IRS publication and I was looking at their examples and I could put the numbers in my financial calculator and get them to come out exactly right. So, and it turned out the age of the examples was a guy who was 50 at the time, I think, or 47 when I did it. It's like, oh, okay, here it is. And I could get the numbers to work and I made it work with all the calculators. And so knowing that I could get my numbers right, I felt confident doing it. And then I got some forms that actually showed my starting point and all the, my numbers, and I saved all my forms. And so I have my files in order for that.
Yeah, we have a little bit of information on this in on 403BWise in the 403B participation participant section under accessing your 403 savings, 403B savings. And you describe it well, and I'll just sort of read what we have. 72T distributions. Retire before age 55 and arrange a schedule of substantially equal periodic payments, a SEP. The payments are based on an IRS formula and must continue for 5 years or until the individual reaches age 59 and a half, whichever takes longer. So for you then, will you go to 59 and a half then?
That's what I'm planning on doing, yes.
Okay.
And Dan, just to jump in on that, so that's for people who retire before 55. Some people may not know that if you retire in the year that you turn 55 or later, you can actually take withdrawals from a 403B without any without any penalty, without that federal 10% penalty, which is kind of the goal of 72T. So 72T is something you want to look at before, if you're retiring before 55. If it's after and your money's still in a 403B, then you don't have to kind of lock yourself into that. But that kind of brings up another question I had for you, Ed, because you're still contributing yes. to 403Bs and potentially 457s along the way. And can you talk to us about how, whether or not you make those contributions all on a pre-tax basis, or do you make some on a pre-tax, some on a Roth basis, based on how much you're contributing, so that maybe, you know, you're not making a pre-tax contribution at like a 0% tax bracket or something like that. What are you, how do you manage those?
Well, every year I do some tax planning, and you've probably read my article, Free Money. Every year I have a Free Money 2016, yes. for example.
Yes.
And this is my tax planning article where I basically add up all our standard deduction, personal exemptions, and I add our child tax credit in. So I have an idea of how much money I can earn and owe zero federal income tax. And then I add the remainder of the 10% bracket in. So generally to get my income down to that level, I go fully pre-tax on all my accounts, my 403B, 457, and IRA. This year, though, 2016. I have money to live on currently, and this is probably our last year for a while. I plan on doing a Roth IRA conversion this year of probably about $25,000 to $30,000, and that should fit in my window of my tax paying threshold. You know, I try to keep it to where I don't go into the 15% bracket.
Got it.
I mean, I actually met with a financial advisor the other day for a thing I'm going to be investing through for the next 8 months, January to August. And I love the initial interviews with them. She's like, "So what's your marginal tax rate?" And I say, 10%. She's like, "How much do you earn?" I'm like, "Well, we earn about 130. Like, how do you do that? And I, you know, and I just love their reactions. And then I, of course, eventually told her about my site and about the podcast I'd done. And yeah, it's fun. You know, I try to be nice. I'm not trying to be a jerk. I used to have kind of an antagonistic attitude in dealing with this 403B reform, but I just found it made me really negative and angry all the time. So I just said, to heck with it. I will take my money. It might have to sit, you know, in a fixed account for 2 years. I will take that opportunity cost. And then I'll move my money when I have to, when I can, with separation of service. So, yeah. And that leads up to the next point about how I invest. Generally, when I'm in high, what I would deem high cost 403B or 457 plans, I just use fixed accounts. I don't do any investing in them because, let's face it, I'm an investing cheapskate. I'm looking at my investments range from about 5 basis points all the way up to 20. That's as high as I'll go. Sorry. I never invest in my 457. I view that as a current account. I view that as an emergency fund, a freedom fund, because it has that flexibility we mentioned earlier. And my 403B money stays in fixed products until I can liberate them by quitting my job and moving my money to my Vanguard IRA.
And how do you allocate it within that once this money's been liberated?
Okay. I'm very big on KISS products. Keep it simple, stupid. I love target retirement funds, or I like life strategy funds that are, you know, the difference being target retirement funds have a preset allocation and they get less aggressive as you get closer to your retirement age of, which is generally considered 65 in these funds, I believe. And then the life strategy funds are just kind of a set allocation. Give you an example. My son has a small account I use for him. I just used a life strategy growth fund. It's 17 basis points, about 80% stock, 20% bond, good split between U.S. stock and total international stock. I don't have to do any thinking or any rebalancing. It's like a personal advisor built into the fund in a sense. So I'm very big on target retirement funds, life strategy funds. Some of my money, I just kind of view it as, you know, take Buffett's view that I'm never going to sell it. I'm just going to hold those funds. And I just hold them in total stock market. And when the market goes down, I'll throw some money in it. Which reminds me, I need to do that today. So I don't do anything too complicated. I'm coming around to the notion that since I do have a teacher's pension and at some point I'll have some Social Security, I have money that's almost equivalent of a bond fund. I can afford to be aggressive in stocks, and I live frugally, so I don't need the money. So I can take those risks.
Again, another example of you are coming from a position of strength.
Well, you know, if it all works out the way I hope it does, I'm sure you saw my article, My Trillionaire Plan.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a trillionaire, and there's no stopping me, by golly.
We could always go to Turkey, right? Isn't like a Turkish millionaire like $10,000, right?
Yeah, you know, I believe on Yodlee, you used to be able to like do your net worth and convert it to, say, rupees.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been a millionaire for years. Yeah.
Wow. Well, just a couple more things here. Do you want to touch on the HSA, the health savings account, and how you've utilized that and why that is such a great retirement plan that maybe is not discussed enough?
The HSA, health savings account, you use that in conjunction with a high deductible health care plan. Now, a lot of people, they want, I guess the new health care is what, platinum, gold, and bronze or something. I'm always looking for the kind of the lower end. We're all really healthy in our family. We eat right. We exercise. We don't hardly ever go to the doctor. And I think it leaves us on the hook with about a $7,000 deductible. But would it allow? So in a sense, it's a catastrophic policy. Okay, if something bad were to happen, after $7,000, it will step in and save our butts financially. But one of the benefits of using that is it allows you the opportunity for almost the equivalent of a health care IRA, might be a good way to phrase it. And for example, this year, 2016, a family can do $6,750. And that is tax deductible, and it grows tax deferred. And you can pull that out later to cover any expenses as long as you're under a high deductible healthcare policy. I think that's the law. But I'm looking at it more like another IRA account, because if my reading of the law is correct, at age 65, you can access that money, I believe, just like an IRA, and use it for non-health related expenses. I think, Scott, you can step in if I'm wrong there. So it has allowed me to take more money off my income and save it to our account. So, and we've done that every year since 2012. So that we're in year five of it. And I think right now my balance on that, and I have not invested in that account yet. We've got over $29,000 in our health savings account.
Wow. That's a nice number. And Scott will attest, even with, Medicare, you're going to have additional healthcare expenses. And so to have that money growing tax-free, tax-deferred, that you can draw on in retirement, I think that's a really nice way to go.
Yeah, it's great. It's always- I mean, geez, you've got the ability to, if you think about it, in retirement, once you hit Medicare age, you've got Medicare Part B premium, which is about $105. Well, now I think it's $122 this year per person. You may have a drug plan. It's going to cost you potentially another $50. You might have a supplemental plan, which could run you another $150 or more. You're looking at $400 or $500 a person at 65. If you can pay for that with pre-tax, tax-free money, that's a huge advantage.
And I don't know if that will cover – will that cover the cost of insurance premiums?
Yeah, you can use it for insurance premiums.
Oh, wow. Oh, I feel like a genius now.
Man.
Wow. All right, so I'll keep funding that then. Let me say this. You know, when you look at an HSA, I had a hard time finding a good platform to invest my money in that. And I did find a credit union. I'm going to say the name if that's all right with you guys.
Yeah, please do.
Element Financial. It used to be Eli Lilly Financial or Federal Credit Union. Well, they have an Ameritrade platform you can get to. This week, I plan on sending about $26,000 to invest in probably a total U.S. ETF. I think it's 5 basis points at Vanguard. And I think my fee to do that transaction is $24. So it's low cost. It's got the diversification I'm looking for. And I'm very thankful I found this. So Elements, don't get rid of this program. You'll force me to move my money.
No, it's good to know, because that's always been a problem with these plans, is where to put the money. There has not been a lot of low-cost options.
No, I found one at Alliant Credit Union in Chicago, and I liked it, and they paid me a nice dividend. But I just didn't like the investment platform I saw. And then I found this other one. I was like, I just was got very excited. So I recommend it.
That's some good advice. Well, we probably only have a couple more minutes. I have a question. What's your end game, Ed? Can you describe, do you want to share what your kind of plans are the next few years, or what do you think?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think, and realistically, my wife and I are ready for a change. We're probably teaching 5 more months. He'll be 10 years old in February. We have an awesome son, and we want to take him to see Latin America. In all truth, we're probably going to set up shop in Mexico. Our Cancun trip was a trial run, and we loved it. So we're probably going to be based out of there, and we're going to use our travel hacking miles that we've earned the last 2 years to go to Brazil, Costa Rica, Puerto Rico, and various other places. So I envision probably homeschooling our son since we're both teachers. I feel we are confident we can do that. And letting him really dive into some culture, but not from a book or a TV program. I want to work on some of my own projects, book ideas I have, work more on my site. I'm a very sporadic blogger. I've got way too many unfinished posts. And I went to FinCon this past year, and I really – that you got to go if you haven't been to that. A lot of awesome people out there blogging, and I want to kind of migrate to doing that. I don't want to say full-time, but more frequently. And I'm just going to enjoy life, and if I come back and feel like teaching, I'm going to jump in and do a year at the most, save all the money and jump out. I don't know what it's going to lead, because there's so many options at this point. And my wife's on board too. She's excited. She's ready to learn some Spanish and Portuguese. We're gonna chronicle all this on our website.
Wow, Scott! I told you this is going to be a great interview.
Hey, are you going to FinCon in 2016, Ed?
I haven't signed up yet, and it was easy this past year because it was in Charlotte. But I would like to go. Yeah, I'm going to try my best to get over there. The people are awesome.
It's in San Diego this year, which is like 45 minutes from me, and me and Dan talked earlier. We're going to get Dan to come out, so we're definitely going to be there. So it'd be cool. We could do another podcast if you come on out.
Oh, that's there's motivation right there for me to get out there.
Hey, heck, and you guys could stay at my house. It's only 45 minute drive, maybe an hour, and there you go. You save some money there.
Everyone heard, right? Everyone heard that? You better be careful making that offer, because I have no problem sleeping on the floor. Well, and my wife wants to go if we go, and I told her we're going to really work on her her online persona of Edwina Mills, and yes.
Oh, I like it. I'll get Mandy to go too. It'll be a couples weekend, Scott.
That'll be fun. Yeah. Yeah. So I would like to go. So I might take you up on that offer.
Oh, this is great. And if I could just sort of sum this up, Ed, your future is bright because you took bold action. And I think, we've talked before the recording, you were very modest saying, I'm not the brightest guy. And you wanted to convey that anyone can do this. But I think you're really smart and really savvy and really street smart. And I bet you were that kind of basketball player too, right? You were probably good physically, but also you had a high basketball IQ.
Well, thank you. That's the ultimate compliment as a basketball player. But yeah, I'm 6'7". Sometimes I had to play out of position and play center. And in D1, you can be undersized. You got to be a little crafty, right?
Great.
A little defensive faking. I'm really good at a shot fake and an up and under, those type of, you're not going to see me windmill dunk. But I was a pretty effective post player. I like to think I was a poor man's Luis Scola, but I think I'm dreaming there.
Do you still play?
Oh, gosh, I'm scheduled to play in a faculty game coming up here about the 19th or 18th or so, and I'm like, oh, I feel so slow when I play. I just turned 52. My body, my mind knows what to do, but, you just don't get to the spots like I used to. I'm going to have to, rely on muscle memory and savvy, deluxe in that game.
Well, those are great skills to have. Well, before we let you go, we like to do something called questions, and Scott and I have developed a question each that we'd like to throw at you. And then again, before we sort of end here, I want you to again say your podcast and give your email address. But before we get to that, Scott, do you want to ask Ed and myself your question?
Yes. Okay. So if you had to play an outdoor sport, so let's football, could be soccer in this case. I know you're a basketball player and Dan's a hockey guy, but I'm more of a soccer guy. Okay, so if your choice was between below zero weather with snow, so we're talking, you know, the Seahawks game this weekend, or I felt this was perfect for you, Ed, 120 degrees with humidity, say in a place like the Middle East, which would you choose?
Wow, those are two horrible choices, but I would go with the 125 and 90% humidity.
Wow.
I actually lived in a place, you know, being I taught at the Naval Academy, mm-hmm. we had, I think it was 50 degrees Celsius, 51 one day, and I looked it up and I was like, wow, it was like literally 125, and everybody's like, well, it's a dry heat. Not on the coast it isn't, and I remember any time we would walk out to our car from our air-conditioned building, our glasses would fog up instantly. Switched outside. And yeah, that would be horrible, but I'm sorry. I grew up in Georgia, and, you know, it was North Georgia, and we got a little snow, but we don't do well in snow. And I know my wife wouldn't come see me play in that game you're describing. We stay out of the tundra.
Okay, Dan, what's your answer?
Gosh, you know, Well, I live in a very dry place right now. I live in New Mexico. I live at about 6,000 feet. In fact, we had quite the snowstorm this morning. And I was born in Buffalo, New York. So I like cold weather. But just because the fact it's been so dry, like right now, I could take a little humidity. So I'm going to agree with Ed. But if you were to interview me later, I may have a different answer.
All right, your turn, Dan.
All right, I actually have two questions, and I was struggling to get one beforehand. And when Scott and I were talking before we started, I'm like, oh my gosh, I forgot to get a question. But I've got two. My first one is, and I think you probably answered this, but maybe not. Ed, would you rather have a great 403B plan and a terrible teaching assignment, or a great teaching assignment and a bad 403B plan?
Oh, wow. I think that would depend on where I was. Now I think I would prefer a good teaching assignment and a bad 403B plan. And you know, even if it's a bad 403B plan, I could make it work because my time horizon, even on a good job, is probably shorter than most people. Yeah. So anytime I can get good students, I prefer that, you know, and nice situation. Because as long as you got the 403B, I can make it work.
Good answer. Scott? Yes. I guess it's not being a teacher, it's probably hard to project, but you are married to a teacher.
My wife's a teacher, so I mean, we contribute to her 403B, and we have what I think is a really good 403B. But you know, you always have the option of not contributing and maybe putting that money elsewhere. And from a mental health perspective, I have to always go with, you know, a great job and a poor 403B, because it's very easy to suffer through a poor 403B. It's not easy to suffer through a bad job.
That's amen. Well said. Okay, and here's my other question I just thought of, just because I want to get a little more basketball information from you. Ed, Cavaliers or Warriors?
Oh, that's so easy. Come on, give me a real question.
Wow, okay, I'm curious. You really got my interest.
Yeah. Well, let's just say I'm a huge Stephen Curry fan, and I've seen Stephen Curry play live. And when you see Stephen Curry play, he makes you doubt your own eyes. I've never seen a player like him. The first time I saw him play, he scored 10 points on 3 3-pointers and a foul shot in about 90 seconds. And I remember the first shot he took was a 3 in transition with no one under. And I was there at the game, right? And I remember thinking to myself, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. What is he doing? That's a horrible shot. And he did the next one just like that. And the fourth one, he took the same bad shot and got fouled and swished it. And I went from knowing that he was a really good player to right then saying, that guy's a Hall of Fame player. He's not even a great player. He's better than great. And I will stand by that assessment today.
Scott, okay, good answer. Scott, how about you?
Well, I'm not a huge basketball fan. Sorry. And I love basketball, but I'm 5'8" with shoes on a good day. So definitely more guard guy. I grew up loving the Portland Trailblazers, but
yeah,
I'm not a big LeBron fan. And one of my major clients is in Sacramento area. So I definitely got to go with Golden State.
I know we're not supposed to answer our own questions, but the reason I ask this is, and this is probably my Rust Belt roots coming out. I was born in Buffalo, and it's famously a city that lost 4 straight Super Bowls. And it was documented in this amazing 30 for 30 called The 4 Falls of Buffalo. If you like these documentaries at all, I think it's one of their better ones. It really captures what that team means to that city and really kind of the character of that city. And so I too agree that I think, Stephon is just a phenomenal player, once in a generation, maybe once in 2 generations. But for me,
yeah,
I want to see a Rust Belt city like Cleveland win a championship. And I think the fact that LeBron would go back there and try to make that happen, I hope he gets at least one there before it's all said and done.
Yeah, I agree. I like LeBron, and I think it, you know, when I coach basketball, I used to tell my players, look, physically, you can't do what he can do, but you can be a good teammate. He's a great teammate, a great leader. I'm a big fan of his too.
Yeah, I think he is. I think it's hard for a superstar to behave that way, especially someone who's probably been famous since he was age 8.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, that can change life perception. Well, Ed, I could talk to you all day, and I know we're going to talk to you again, and we really hope we can connect in person. Before we let you go, what is the best way to contact you, Ed?
Sure. It's easy to find me at my website, www.millionaireeducator.com. And my email is millionaire.educator@gmail.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can get the links to access my site from there. I'm on Twitter. I do a little bit here and there, but easiest at my website.
And I have a feeling a lot more content's going to be coming right around July, August, I have a feeling.
Yeah, you can count on it.
We'll look forward to it. And boy, I can't wait to hear about that, because we have, as I mentioned earlier, 11-year-old, and I've got all these notions in the back of my mind. And I wish I spoke Spanish. I don't. I think that opens up a whole nother world for you.
Well, there's always language school in Guatemala. It's inexpensive, and you get a one-on-one tutor. Give yourself 2 months, and you'll be speaking Spanish.
Oh, wow. Well, so my son goes to a Spanish immersion school, so he actually is pretty fluent.
Oh, awesome.
Feel very lucky, although it's very hard for me to pull Spanish out of him. But when people who are fluent come over, they converse pretty easily. So,
Yeah,
we feel so good about that. It's an interesting school, not to go on too much longer, but they don't make the kids do homework in elementary school, which I'm a big believer in, having taught elementary school. He's a bright kid, but I come away just satisfied that I know that he has learned a foreign language, and I think that's just amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's a great building block for other language study too.
Yeah, and I feel like we've got to get him into the world to continue to build that. So Ed, great talking to you. Scott, always love connecting. Any last thoughts from you, Scott?
No, Ed, we really appreciate you having us on and keep doing those blog posts. I know it's hard to find time to do that kind of stuff, but keep them coming, man. We love it.
Well, I'd like to just say one last thing here. I really appreciate the fact, all the information you guys have put out over the years. As I said in the blog post that I wrote for you guys saved me a lot of money, gave me a lot of guidance, and I want you to know I appreciate what you and Steve Shulo did. I'm a big fan. You know, I've been following you guys for over 10 years now, so I'm very thankful for you guys.
Oh, that means the world to us, and that you are exactly the reason we do this. So thank you, Ed. We really appreciate that.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Take care, you guys.
All right. Bye-bye.